You know it, you missed it, you loved it. Welcome back to Our Bikes on Motorsport 101. Our Bikes, the sequel, Bike Harder. Hey everybody, welcome to episode 628 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighborhood host, Dre Harrison. Glad you could join us as per usual. I've already got RJ O'Connell jumping out of his seat like he really is a part of the band Madness. That's something I didn't think I'd expect to see tonight. But here we are. but it's time for the second part of season preview season. And this time we're going to get into MotoGP and its 2026 season. And in some ways, quite a boring entry into a year, given it's the last year of a regulation set. But also, a lot of shit has gone down in the last couple of months that actually make this quite interesting. We'll be breaking it all down over the next couple of hours right here on the show. But I can't do that alone. I've got my guests with me. First up, RJ O'Connell, have you finished dancing?
I'm just doing the thing out of that gif of the Marquez brothers just like throwing it back, pulling it forward, leaning it back. Look, it's my job here mostly to just be the facilitator, be the point guard, lobbing it up in the paint to my two power forwards of motorcycling knowledge and expertise and banter. And I know y'all have been chomping at the bit to talk about some of the stuff that we're going to be talking about this week.
Without a doubt, there is a lot to get through here, let me tell you. And doing that with me, as one half of the two towels, the Tim Duncan to my David Robinson, it's Cameron Buckley. Hello, Cam. How's it going?
That is the nicest thing that anyone has ever said to me, bar none.
You're welcome. You should call
even, it. Even after the show, even Nigel has joined us. To share his biking knowledge. No, Nigel, they're the Harley Davidsons of the support series, Nigel, because we got baggers this year, which fucks.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You love that. Yes. All of that and much, much more to get through in the next couple of hours. So I'm not going to waste too much more of your time. I'm going to tell you the general housekeeping before we get into the show as per. We are on youtube.com/motorsport101. We're on facebook.com/motorsport101. We're on Twitter at motorsport_101. If you have to follow our personal handles on Blue Sky, you can do that. Dre Harrison, CBuckD917 at rjoconnell.bsky.social. If you want some highlights of the show in video form, you can at motorsport101 pod on Instagram and m101_podcast on TikTok. You can check us out on there. You can also check out the website, motorsport101.com. If you like your previews to be more in a written format, digestible, then you can listen to the Haters Guide to the 2026 season, written by yours truly, breaking down all of the teams and all the extra news going into the 2026 season. You can check that out if you prefer your content in written form. And if you really, really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our episodes before they go live to the public. You can upgrade to the $10 tier to send these episodes live as they're being recorded. Ghost Raptor, Jason, they're doing that right now, as well as Max. Thanks for listening in, gents. Much appreciated. Thank you for the continued support. Right, without further ado, let's preview the 2026 MotoGP season.
It's time, and in my role as the facilitator, the point guard, let's lay out some of the major changes that we've had over the offseason. We talked about it as the last season wrapped up. Honda has now moved into Tier C of concessions. It means they get a few less tires in testing. They can no longer test with their full-time Grand Prix riders. They use an aero update and can now no longer develop their engine once it's homologated for the current season. Speaking of engines, we say goodbye to the inline four Grand Prix motorcycle. It's gone the way of so many things. Blockbuster Video, Game, the game retailer in the United Kingdom, parts of Europe.
We live among empires that once thought themselves eternal.
The Oldsmobile Motor Company, yeah. Yamaha now has the V4 engine. on their motorcycle. We got a lot to talk to when it comes to Yamaha. Also, Baggers, FIM, Harley Davidson, Bagger World Cup.
Got Baggers.
Joining the support series at six of the rounds of 2026. Get a little bit more in the calendar as well. And also, one of the big ones, Dorna Sports, as we know it, is no longer Dorna Sports. It is now MotoGP Sport Entertainment. Former F1 CEO Chase Carey is now in charge as president of MotoGP Sport Entertainment. Carmelo Ezpeleta is still here, keeps his role as CEO, with Dan Rossomondo leaving as COO in the off season. Now it's time for Dre to talk to us about this very big calendar.
It's still what it was last year, a 22-round calendar, the joint biggest in MotoGP history alongside the last couple of years. Last year was actually the first time we actually got all 22, given cancellations like Valencia's awful flooding, for example. But this is a very different calendar. Like, there's some big changes that Dorna has put through. What's an article on that? MGSE. That's going to take some getting used to, by the way, let me tell you. But here is a quick breakdown of the 2026 MotoGP calendar. Thailand keeps its spot as the opener, where that's this weekend on March 1st. Then we take a couple of weeks off for the return of Brazil. Brazil is on the calendar at the brand new Ayrton Senna Nelsinho track. If you've never seen it, it looks a lot like a roval. It's actually looks quite quick. Could be interesting. You have to keep an eye on that one. It's now part of a doubleheader alongside a traditional fan favorite, the United States Grand Prix at Austin at the Circuit of the Americas. Then, due to the month of Ramadan, Qatar is now round four on April 12th. And then the first of the four Spanish land rounds, Jerez, the Spanish Grand Prix, April 26th. Then Le Mans on May 10th. Expect 110,000 plus on race day, arguably the blue ribbon event of the calendar now, at least in terms of fan turnout and support. The Fabio fans will be loud and plentiful. Then a change. Catalunya is now in the middle of May. It's on May 17th now, rather than its usual September slot. It's been moved into the springtime. Interesting move there. Then we've got Mugello on May 31st. That's now in a back-to-back with Ballaton Park. Ballaton was in September last year. It's now been moved on to June 7th. I'm not sure having two Ballaton Park Grand Prix so close to each other is going to get fans turning up for it, given we've had two in basically 9 months. More on that later on in the year. Also moving, Brno is now before the summer break on June 21st. That's now another doubleheader alongside the Assen TT. You know it, you love it, the fan favourite. That's on June 28th. Then the Saxon Ring keeps its traditional spot as the last round before the summer break. That's on July 12th. We take a month off. We come back to Silverstone, back in its original slot, first round after the break on August 9th. Then, for some reason, we take 2 weeks off, and then we go to Aragon at the end of August. That, again, new slot for Aragon there, towards the end of the summer, as opposed to the middle of the summer, which it used to be in. Odd. Then we've got Misano on September 13th. That's now a back-to-back with Austria, the last round before the flyaways now. That's on September 20th. Then we get the flyaway big six rounds to close out the year have not changed. So Japan on October 4th, Indonesia at Mandalika the week after. Then we take 2 weeks off because we'll take a week off because we split the flyaways now. Phillip Island for the last time as we know it, more on that very shortly, on October 25th. That's a back-to-back with Sepang on November 1st, and then the Iberian Peninsula closes it out again with Portimao on November 15th and Valencia on November 22nd. It is a very different calendar compared to what we've normally seen for MotoGP. It makes sense. I think they've put a lot more of the European rounds together to cut down on travel. I think Hungary and Czechia being close together was exactly for that reason. I think having Austria close out the European block makes sense. It's relatively close to Italy as well, where Misano is and what have you. I think it's logistically, it makes sense, is what I would say. I don't think there's any huge howlers here. They clearly learned their lesson from Silverstone last year by putting it back in September, back in August, where it normally is in the middle of the summer. I'm curious to see how Brazil gets on. I think it's a decent looking track, actually, so I'm looking forward to seeing how Brazil gets down and what kind of turnout we're getting there. And it all makes sense from where I'm sitting. The question is, the big one, and I mentioned it in the rundown. As of last week, February 20th, it was made official that the Australian Grand Prix is leaving Phillip Island. This year's race will be the last as we know it there. The race itself is moving. It is moving to the Adelaide Street Circuit from 2027. It is there on a 6-year deal. It's a similar layout to the supercars circuit, big main straight through the main park itself. They're expecting 340 kilometers an hour by the time you're hitting the brakes into that braking zone there, using a lot of the parkland around Adelaide. I mean, calling it a street circuit is a little extreme, but I think it's a lot more like Ballaton in the sense of kind of in the middle of nowhere in that sense, and kind of like a hybrid in that sense. It's a weird one, but oh boy.
I know y'all have had a couple of weeks to just, maybe a week or two, to just kind of think about this, ruminate on this. I'm going to let you two gentlemen off the leash here for a bit, because I'll tell you what I think about it. I'm not a fan. And I know all the angles as to why they would consider this change. And look, for the racing fans in South Australia, like, that's got to be cool, right? You get another big marquee event in Adelaide. Remember, Adelaide, the street circuit, was almost done away with completely. Just a couple of years ago, they brought the supercars back. And now the plan is they're going to have MotoGP racing on the Adelaide street circuit, park circuit, whatever we call this. First of all, it sucks that Phillip Island is gone. The biggest event they're going to have motorcycle-wise is World Superbikes. Not a fan. It's one of the best tracks, has been for some time, has delivered us so many classics. It's hard to get. I know it's hard to get to. I know the facilities aren't great, but you know what? You know what? Just it sucks that it's a loss leader, and now MotoGP Sport Entertainment decides it's no longer worth keeping around.
For what it's worth, there's rumblings in the air that they might not keep the World Superbike contract, which expires in 2027 either, which would be a double hammer blow to Phillip Island if it lost its two marquee events on the racing calendar. Getting World Superbikes as a traditional season opener, which we just had this past weekend. Shout out to Nicolò Bulagoff, who triple-headed that weekend, exactly as the form book suggested.
Look, if there was such a thing as betting on someone to win every race in the year, still take the over.
Exactly.
Is this what NASCAR fans felt like when they took Darlington, one of their races, away in the mid-2000s?
You know, that's probably a better comparison than you realize you've just made. Because there was a huge amount of backlash around that. Mm-hmm. And eventually it had to be backtracked upon because the races that they gave that date to just didn't pull the numbers the way Darlington would. That said, how's the court of public opinion on this decision when we're comparing them to decisions made by NASCAR in the second half of the 2000s?
Not great, Bob. Or should I say, really, not great, Jim.
Brian, in this case, actually, at the time.
Yeah, fair enough.
There is so much to unpack.
So I try and lay down some of the context as to why this has happened first and foremost. I know RJ kind of did a little bit, but before Cam fully goes off the cork, because I'm a bit more business minded than my colleagues here. I've got a degree in business studies. Well, I've had an A level, but that's it. I could have had a degree in business studies if I really wanted to, but I got bored of that, so I tried journalism instead. Worked out all right. point I'm getting at here is that RJ made a lot of correct points in allusion to this. I spoke to David Emmett about this, and even David has openly admitted to me, for you know, David Emmett from Moto Matters, follow him if you haven't already, fantastic Viking coverage, one of the best in the business. He's never made it to Phillip Island because it's too far a pilgrimage for him, because he also travels most of the world by bike rather than plane. And he said to me, and I quote from friends of the show, "The highlight of being at Phillip Island from a facility standpoint is that there's a barista in the media center." That's it. We talked about this last year. It's pretty much an open secret that MotoGP is giving more time and focus towards the Premier Class. They need more garage space, more paddock space, so that the sport can try to appeal to getting those VIP names to come in and visit, and they want to be impressed, and they want to have the space to show off their teams and motorcycles and hospitality. Something that Moto2 and Moto3 has had to compromise on as a direct result of that. Phillip Island has not upgraded its paddock and facilities in the best part of a couple of decades. It is a rough track in terms of facilities. I'm almost certain as well that they lose money on it overall from a MGSE standpoint, because they struggle to get fans through the door. It tops out normally around 40,000 on race day. That's low. That's really low compared to some. As I said before, Le Mans is now at over 110,000 on a Sunday. There's no getting around it. This is what we would call in business a loss leader. It's something you suck up because you know you're making money elsewhere. Liberty's not in the business of having loss leaders. There's a reason why it's taken tracks like Imola and Hockenheim round the back of the barn and shot it since becoming owner of the series. It has a business model. Its business model is bring the racing to the people, take it to the streets, and get big names through the door, get big name activations going, and like I said, bring the racing to the people. Miami has been an objective success for Formula One. They've dumped $500 million into Vegas. Imola is gone, and Singapore is now like basically Monaco 2 on the calendar. Say what you will about Liberty, it's not popular with fans doing this, but this is a sport that was bought for $6 billion. It's now worth $22 billion, according to Reuters.
Formula One, years. We're talking about here.
Yeah, this is Formula One. This is why Liberty spent the $4 billion on buying MotoGP in the first place, because they genuinely believe they can turn it into a big, major brand, and taking a race venue to a street track, first of its kind, according to them, although not really if you know your history, first of the modern age, I guess you could say, in terms of going to a street-like circuit, is their idea of bringing the racing to the people, because it's worked in Formula One. That's why we're at where we're at. There's problems with that, mind you. Cam, hit them with it.
With what?
I teed you up here. Like, you can now rant and rave about how shit this is.
We've just traded like the best motorcycle racing track on the planet for what feels like bigger Balaton Park is what they're going to turn Adelaide into. And that race wasn't that great last year. I'm just dejected, honestly. I don't even have the energy to be angry about it.
We've lost, for me, the best track on the calendar. I fully agree with Cam on that. My two favorite MotoGP races of all time are Phillip Island Australian Grand Prix 2015 and 2017.
2015, I'll go a step further. It's the greatest motor race I've ever watched. Two or four wheels.
It's up there. It is right up there. It is a very special race in the context of the championship, the action, the storytelling, the ending. It has everything. It takes every possible.
That was the weekend that teed up the kick.
The real one. There was a couple of like, it's, if you watch wrestling, it's a bit like Zarya and Sol Ruka and their feud they've had on NXT. There was a couple of hints along the way, but the big one was Phillip Island, in the same way that the big one was taking somebody's title shot away. It's that kind of shit. But it's not only that. This is the classic battle of legacy fans versus chasing the golden carrot, or what they think the golden carrot is. Like, we are all Formula One fans here, and we've all noticed the same trend. And this was even before Liberty bought out Formula One. This was going this way beforehand, with street tracks going away from conventional road courses and realizing that that market model doesn't make bread like it used to. Like, the new way is activations, sponsorships, big events. When Chase Carey bought the sport, it was 25 Super Bowls. That was the motto that he had. And generally speaking, he's made it work that way. And it was inevitable when MGSE was bought out by them that they were going to eventually go the same way. Because, like I said, it's worked. Objectively, from a commercial standpoint, it has worked. Formula One has never been worth as much as it's been worth right now. Like, they are eating good over there, and that's why they want to just do it again. Hell, if you've not seen on social media the wired different promo that MotoGP has done to launch this season.
It is a direct copy paste of Engineered Insanity.
And what did Engineered Insanity entail? Oh, I know. The whole crazy, super fast editing style, the drama of Formula One, the push into America to try and basically get that market going.
The time
again.
When Oliver and our server put the Dragon Ball Z theme over it, and it went incredibly hard.
Yeah. And the small, unimportant matter of a reality show called Drive to Survive.
Which MotoGP is also. MotoGP is also trying to chase the carrot. Let's call it what it is. Because they won't call it that.
And bike fans don't want to call it that because they hate the idea of copying anything from Formula One. There's always been a classist divide between bike fans and car fans when it comes to shit like this. Always has been.
And they are pulling everything out of the F1 handbook, which has objectively worked. But in order to ensure they don't piss off those legacy fans, they try and put the veneer of something else on it.
I wish they were more honest about it, to be like the thing is, right, is that they were very blunt about this to the Victorian government. They said, look, we want to move this race to Albert Park. It is your choice about how you want to do this. And Victoria's government basically said, we did everything that they asked of us, but we weren't prepared to move the Grand Prix to Albert Park because they probably didn't want to spend the money renovating that to make it bike
friendly. They would have to knock half the track's facilities down to make it anything resembling safe for motorcycle racing. And then you would have people on the F1 side having a conniption because you would have to move all the walls out and get rid of all the gravel. And then the racetrack is neutered.
So then here's the question. Why do they think that doing the same to Adelaide is going to work out? Because I've watched that in supercars, and I watched that in Formula One some time ago. That looks a whole lot less ready to convert into a proper MotoGP track than did Albert Park. And to your point, Trey, this isn't the first street race, and people will get technical and say, well, actually, Manalika is a street circuit because they were meant to build all this infrastructure around it, yada, yada, yada.
It's a street track where they forgot to build everything around it to turn it into one.
It's a street track in the same way that Aleix Espargaró likes calm, rational discourse.
And I fully agree with RJ. As I look at Adelaide and I look at the facilities there, there will be a portion of this track that basically goes out into the park so that they can build motorcycle-specific facilities and corners for it. Because a lot of those walls are way too goddamn close to race motorcycles with. Although that doesn't.
Yeah, there's a reason why we stopped. Why we stopped running the Isle of Man Tourist Trophy as part of this calendar some time
Same
ago.
Same brain cell, because I just had the thought, I'm like, if I'm having to compare this, well, they run that the Isle of Man, and then you go, oh, they run those kind of walls at the Isle of Man. You don't want that comparison.
No, you don't want that comparison. And look, they've got smarter people than us working out the safety requirements in there. And to be fair, people like Jack Miller and Aleix Espargaró, who have forgotten more about bike racing than we know on this show, have both said it can be done. If they're saying that, I'm inclined to believe them. Cam.
And those same smarter minds put in the Misano style curbs that almost killed Jorge Martin last year. So
I never said they were perfect.
Far from it, actually. We ran at Austria with no chicane on the run up the hill for how many years? And only took Valentino. Almost took Valentino Rossi catching an intercontinental ballistic motorcycle to the dome for them to think, maybe put a corner there. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And this is the problem. Like, I would say, yeah, okay, they think they know what they're doing on this one. One, it could rain. Two, I would also say, is this worth it? And three, I would also think the only reason they're pulling this off, Adelaide, to answer your question, RJ, is because it's 10 minutes from the city centre. Mm-hmm. Rather than having to go to a goddamn island to watch a Grand Prix.
Right.
It's
in the middle of nowhere relative to Australia, but it's not in the middle of nowhere relative to the region. Well, I would also say Adelaide mm-hmm. is a bit of a sleepy hollow, so we'll see if people roll up to it. It's just there's so many moving parts that it's hard to say definitively one way or the other how the race that we're gonna get is gonna go. All I know is that the racetrack that we are losing has put on some of the best shows I've ever seen in my life on two wheels, production based or prototype, and shit sucks.
Ray,
you have a theory.
Yeah,
you have a theory that maybe. Okay, we know it's not going to be Phillip Island in 2027, but you have a feeling that it might not be Adelaide in 2027 either.
I still have... I can't take full credit for the theory because that goes to Simon Patterson at the race. Fair play to old Van Man for pointing this one out. In the press release, the backup plan is the Bend. And that's a relatively new track built out there in that sort of Adelaide region that is much more of a conventional road course. So I don't think they've had anything bigger than GT's race around it on four wheels, if memory serves.
Yeah, but, they got a supercars round. They did Asian Le Mans back in the day, but pre-COVID. That's about it, really.
Yeah, I think if this bombs and they aren't confident they can pull this off, it ends up there instead. And believe me when I tell you, no one's going to be happy if that's the outcome in the end. Because what the Bend is to me is Australian Snetterton. And Snetterton is a perfectly acceptable racetrack. It's just dull.
It is. Do you want some bread with your bread? Nothing on it. All white.
Yeah, and that's where I've got a feeling that this may end up, because I'm still not fully... I mean, let me put it to you this way. MotoGP at Adelaide might not be the problem. Moto3 at Adelaide might be the problem.
You ain't pack racing around there.
Well...
You will be, but you ain't doing it. You ain't getting out the other side.
It's something that I've heard no one talk about with this. What about Moto3 and its pack racing? What if somebody gets clipped and caught on an apex like it so commonly happens in that series? What if we get a pack race of 15, 20 riders, and if one person ends up making a minor mistake and going down? Right. We've seen some of the safest tracks in the world have leg breakers and worse in the last decade. Right.
What have we talked about ever since Dorna picked up tabs with MotoGP? Or with Liberty. It's all about the top class. Lower class be damned. World Superbike be damned.
Yeah, I didn't hear it called MotoGP and World Superbike Entertainment. Now,
nope,
did it?
Not even Moto Sports Entertainment would have been perfect. No, it is MotoGP, and everything else is made lesser now. And you can do that, all well and good, but it's still... You know, living, breathing people getting thrown a leg over motorcycles to go compete at these tracks. And you do need to consider how all involved classes are going to race there. Did Moto 3 yeah. Moto 3 at Albert Park would be even worse.
Absolutely. Somebody makes a mistake on the final corner, they're going straight into the outside wall and dying.
You have to toss that whole, like, Albert Park, the fact that they even tabled it. while looking at that track is nuts, because the whole final sector has to go. The whole, with the changes they made, actually old Albert Park would probably be a little bit more suitable. The changes they made on the run up to the quick left right hander, you'd have to knock those walls back. It's easier said than done.
Far too much work. And I know it's temporary, so I know they probably could do it, but it would take a lot of time and a lot of effort, and there's not a lot of actual space left in Albert Park to play
with. And a lot of screaming from F1 fans that one of their favorite tracks just got neutered so someone else can race there.
Also, it's a public park still. Like 30 years ago, people were rightly complaining that their public park was getting turned into a racetrack.
Ethically, I don't think it's a good look that a sport that is now running on 100% sustainable fuels is now chopping down trees to build a racetrack in the middle of a park in Australia. Not necessarily what I would call good optics. Mm-hmm. We talked around a little bit in circles. I'm going to put a neat little bow on this segment, but for me, it is a massive disappointment as a bike fan. Look, I get it. I am a legacy fan. I will be exploited to shit on this because at the end of the day, I know I'm not going to stop watching anytime soon. Of course, I will watch Adelaide and see how it goes down, but I'm not going to be happy about it because we've lost the best bike track on the planet, a fan favorite that everybody loved, that everybody was excited to have, ones that's loved by fans and riders alike, all in the name of profit. And if there was one instance of having a loss leader on your books that was worth keeping for the sake of fan goodwill, it was this one. As much as big business is a thing, I don't want it to become what this sport is overall. And that's what annoys me.
And if the best racetrack on two wheels can get cut, any of them can.
No, nothing is safe.
Absolutely not. We've got some teams and riders to talk about here. And traditional M101 season preview fashion, we're going to go from the bottom to the top in terms of the constructors order or the vibes order. And in this case, we start off with the clear leader to lead this off under either of those metrics. It's Yamaha as a constructor. Winter is coming. There was a lot of hope over the switch to the V4 engine, which we talked about. But when it debuted in Misano last season, it was the final straw for Fabio Quartararo, who has a deal in place to leave in 2027 and move to Honda. Unthinkable. Jumping across the aisle of Japanese manufacturers. A Sepang test that featured a broken finger, a lost days running due to technical concerns, a middle finger thrown, and three-time World Superbike champion Top Rack Raz Gadioglu being so tall he can't use the rear aero yet. True story. Quartararo admitted by the end of the Buriram test that the team is still 7 to 8 tenths off the field, and we think he was being generous. There isn't much to look forward to here, but for the purposes of documentation, the Monster Energy Yamaha factory team is still Fabio Quartararo and Alex Rins, 9th and 19th in last year's championship, respectively. Prima Pramac MotoGP team is the aforementioned 3-time World Superbike champion Top Rack Raz Gadioglu, joined by Jack Miller, 17th in points last year. I know, and especially this will be the case in Formula One, don't look too much into like who's leading at the top of the leaderboards, but sometimes there are outcomes that just like, yeah, you can tell from preseason testing that things aren't going great. And suffice to say, fellas, this is one of those cases, and it ain't no good way.
What precisely is good about Yamaha at the moment?
The bike's blue.
That's gone.
It's not even that much of it's blue anymore. Much of it's just Monster Energy paint now. Let's rip the bandage off here. When you throw a middle finger at a motorcycle, it's probably your cue to exit. It was for Marc Marquez at Sachsenring in 2023 with Honda. And indeed, a middle finger was thrown from Fabio Quartararo at the Yamaha M1. Despite its V4, Yamaha are suffering a lot of the same problems they traditionally have in the last half decade. And by all accounts, he's out.
He said in the Sepang test that nothing is signed yet, but as mentioned on this show earlier in the year, Yuri Puigdemont, who is the best scooper in the business of MotoGP, maybe in all of motorsport, quite frankly, broke this story basically last week in January that he's going to Honda. It's just not official yet. And I can't blame him. He's been extremely patient. He's been with this team from the, he's been with Yamaha from the very start. Yamaha were the ones who, an SRT back when it was the Raslan Rosaldi team, took a punt on him. Relatively speaking, did not think it would ever be this. But won a world championship with them in 2021, has been one of the three or four fastest riders in MotoGP pretty much from day one. And he's been the talisman of this team, and he's had enough, which is basically, this is despite the fact the man is on $12 million a year. He's the highest paid man in MotoGP to try and stick this out and figure this out. And even he has basically done a Marquez and said, you know what, keep your money.
That's exactly it. Like he's wasting his prime. And we know Fabio Quartararo.
He's 28 now.
He's 28. He has, thankfully, other than the occasional burst of arm pump, he's been mostly healthy the last couple of years. And he has not featured at the front of the grid basically since the middle of 2022, when Ducati finally cracked the code on the Decimo Sedici GP and blew their ass away and hasn't stopped blowing their ass away. And Yamaha just kind of spun its wheels the whole time. They haven't gotten that much better. Even the next entity that we will talk about troughed much deeper than them and has rebounded. This year, this bike that they have built has to be what they then carry into the next regulation set. This is a year of figuring out what a V4 needs to go fast around a racetrack before we get the 850cc's next year. There's no guarantee they nail that. And on current evidence, it feels like Yamaha just, they sink ever deeper.
There's also the sinking feeling that for Alex Rins on the factory bike and Jack Miller on Pramac, that they are basically running the season on borrowed time, that by this time next year, neither of them could be in MotoGP anymore. Because along with Fabio, like, this could be a clean reset for the entire brand outside of Top Rack, who, because we know the bike is not good, we don't know what success is going to look like for him coming straight out of Superbikes into MotoGP.
Well, it was a fun line from him where he is like, why do these tires slip on the straight?
Yeah.
Because he's coming from Pirellis and World Superbikes, which, get your jokes in, Formula One people, the Pirelli tire is actually consistent on two
wheels. Everybody loves the Pirelli tires over in World Superbike.
Yep. That's one of the few good things they look forward to over on that side of the aisle. But yeah, to clarify what RJ is saying, yes, everybody at Yamaha is in a contract year except for Top Rack, who is off sequence on a 2-year contract. So right now, Fabio is probably gone. Alex Rins is under massive pressure to keep his job. He was 19th in the points last year. And Jack Miller is on a 1-year contract. He got beaten out Miguel Oliveira, which was... yeah, it's a bit like Manchester United beating the League Two side in the FA Cup. And trust me, this year that was not guaranteed.
Two dumb bitches going exactly.
Yeah, they are the worst factory coming off the test. That is more than obvious, as Fabio
didn't even
said,
mention it. We wasn't even in the set list. I forgot. They also had to park the bikes for a day because they had a fundamental part problem on the V4s that were starting to blow up.
Yeah. They were going to explode. They had to take a day out to make sure what the issue was and whether it was an electronic issue or something else. So they actually sacrificed an entire day's running in Sepang to figure that out. And that doesn't include Fabio crashing and breaking a bone in his finger and saying, you know what, I'm good, basically. He said himself when he broke his finger, look, if it was a Grand Prix weekend, I'd have stuck it out. But for a test?
No. Somewhere he's probably not sticking around as well.
If there was any hope, and if what Fabio is saying is true, that he hasn't signed the dotted line yet, and I'm inclined to believe him because I've got no reason to think he's a liar. If there was any hope that Yamaha might be able to convince him that there was something here worth staying for,
it's gone. Back of this, it died off the middle finger at the gas tank.
Even
more so than that, you think about going into the next regulation set. If Fabio is not a sure thing, and it might be Rins, it might be all three of them gone, Well, whose data are you using for next year?
Toprax? A guy
who can't use Rear Arrow because he's too tall, and no one figured that out?
Yeah, like, but to clarify this, this is actually quite a little funny story here. For context, Toprak is the tallest man on the MotoGP grid. He's a genuine 6'1". He's a very tall man for a bike rider. Tallest man in the field. There is a small quirk in the rules. Because Yamaha had to move around this seating position to make him a bit more comfortable, because, again, he's very long-limbed. He's got massive, if you see him, he's got massive beanpole legs. He's like a Viking version of Peter Crouch. Point I'm getting at here is that there was a rule in the book that says the top height of the seat cannot be more than 15 centimeters away from the top of your highest point of your rear aero. So because the gap between the two is more than 15 centimeters, they can't run the rear aero on the back of Toprak's bike because it would be deemed illegal in the technical regulations.
The legality box that they fall foul of in this case is a man.
Yes, it's because Toprak is so freakishly tall, Yamaha didn't take it into account when they were trying to move the seat around for him, and now they can't run the rear arrow on his bike yet. They're trying to figure out a solution, but it's not ideal, and it's only because Toprak is basically 6'1".
That's just a microcosm of everything about Yamaha right now, but back to that, like, if Fabio's frozen out of the data, and Alex Rins is going out so sad, and it makes me sad because he is a supremely talented rider, but he still can't walk right. That crash on the Honda ended his career in the grand scheme of things.
I think there's permanent leg damage there that he's not spoken about publicly.
You can see it. You can see it when he walks.
Yeah. You know, it's just so sad that a guy that was a top five rider in this sport at his very best, a multiple race winner with Suzuki and Honda, one of the few dudes in the field that's won on two manufacturers, is going out so sad because he's an immensely gifted rider. It's just, and we actually found out last week that once upon a time he was offered the chance to race at Gresini. And he chose the Honda factory deal instead, which is completely understandable at the time.
Yeah. Get the factory money.
So you get the factory paycheck. He was promised by Honda that he was going to get a full-blown factory deal. Same bike as Mark. And obviously, big paycheck. He took it over the Gresini deal. They're offering him peanuts and a dream. And well,
3 years prior, that would have been a great deal.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the power, it's unfortunately the meme of Apollo and the Gift of Prophecy. Instead, the dodgeball is replaced with a hammer. It's just deeply unfortunate how his career's turned out in that sense.
Suddenly turns into, what can Yamaha do to actually right this ship? It might be their next regime of riders, and already being in the 850cc class, to actually get a direction going if they're going to lose three of their four, and one of them is still learning how to ride one of these dang prototypes.
I look back to 2003, because there's a lot of mythology around 2003, because the following year, Valentino Rossi goes and wins the world championship when everybody thought it was impossible, because Yamaha in 2003 was bad. And I look at Yamaha's results in 2003. Carlos Checa had like a handful of top fives. Marco Melandri had a top five finish. They were fifth in the team's championship. And I'm just thinking, man, I think they take that compared to now.
Yeah, because Valentino went there with Jeremy Burgess. Is like, here's a picture of the Honda. Make it ride like this.
I don't think a eureka moment like that is coming down the pipeline for Yamaha. No. I really hope they turn things around over the course of the season, but we expect it to be tough, certainly at the start of the year. Let's go to Honda, because as Cam alluded to, they did dig deeper troughs than Yamaha has, and they bounced back. They made some genuine progress in 2025. They got a win. Johann Zarco won at Le Mans in front of the home fans. Four podium finishes across the two teams. Zarco and rookie Moto2 champion Diogo Moreira of Brazil are tied down for long-term deals at LCR, the satellite team, but with Cordero likely on the way. It may be a straight fight between factory riders Yoann Mir and Luca Marini for the second factory bike, with the speed of Mir dueling with the consistency and the feedback of Marini. It's a tough call for a team that now wants to get into the top six more frequently after a taste of success last year. It may be Honda's first boring preseason in 7 years. Genuine smiles in the camp get the impression that they could make yet more progress. And look, for them, the job is not finished. This is still Honda. We know what they once were. They're not there just yet.
No. However, I can actually feel the slightest like tinge of optimism towards HRC going into a season, because
we're not getting an F1.
No, not right now. Maybe they do call it
coming up on our next.
They don't call it the Adrian Newey Chassis Company for nothing. Although at this point, with the Aston's naming rights in the air, it might end up turning into that.
Back to the car bikes, company.
At least the bikes are good.
The bikes looked uneventful in preseason. They just went out. They did laps. They set some fast laps. They set some consistent laps. And there was a few wry smiles going on in the Honda camp. We haven't had this for like 8 years. Oh,
yeah.
Good. Like,
it's worth pointing out, Yoann Mir had the fourth fastest overall time in the Sepang test on a Honda. That was genuinely impressive stuff. Mir has been a bit critical, saying that we still need a bit of a revolution on the rear grip of the bike. They're still spinning it up a little bit when they need to. But there's genuine optimism. Yeah, the rest ain't bad, and there's genuine optimism in the Honda camp for the first time in
2018.
At least half a decade, that there's some genuine hope that Honda might actually be competitive this year. And I'm talking about the front end. Because look, if you look back on last year, a good day had Honda in the top six.
Easily. Really good day had them on the podium.
Johann Zarco won Le Mans.
Zarco won Le Mans. Yes, there were shenanigans involved, but he also followed up with a second place at Silverstone on merit.
You know where there were not shenanigans? Yoann Mir tying that bike into knots and getting it on the podium in Motegi.
And that's the interesting thing, because I'm glad that Mir is feeling good, because as Ghost Raptor points out, this is potentially a career year, which is a strange thing to say about a previous world champion. He won in 2020 with Suzuki, who's still not yet 30 years old and was, at his peaks, quicker than Luca Marini.
That's the issue, because I think they are two fundamentally different riders with two very different philosophies, and Honda's got a good chance of having to, they're going to have to likely choose between one of these two to be the remaining guy on their factory team, because every other seat is tied in by the sounds of it. Luca Marini, he had the horrible lung puncture when he was out in Japan testing for the 8-hour team, and after that he got better. It was amazing that he was a regular fixture in the top eight, even in the top six in the back half of the year, and was superb in terms of consistency and basically bringing home top tens pretty much all the way in the back half of the year. But he doesn't have the outright speed that Yoann Mir does, because as Cam alluded to, Mir had two dry, shenanigan-free podiums in the back half of the year at Sepang and Motegi, where he was third on merit and pace alone. But he also crashed 19 times last year.
And we can only mitigate about eight of those. There was a few of them that weren't his fault. There were a few of them where he went into the corner with no regard for his own safety and dumped the bike.
Reckless abandon.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. I wonder where they're going to go, because Luca Marini has worked very hard to earn good favor in Honda. He was apparently universally applauded for going out of his way to help out the 8-hour team, even though he knew halfway through that he was not going to be on that team. He stuck around to try and help out, and that's when he punctured his damn lung, poor guy, with a horror crash at turn one at Suzuka. But he's worked very hard. He's one of the most intelligent riders on the grid. He's very smart. He's excellent with feedback. Honda's been very grateful to the amount of effort he's put in to help improve them. But Mir is more talented, and that might be where they draw the line on this.
Well, here's
because
the thing.
Mir is Mir.
Well, they still need that feedback, both from him and Zarco, because they are still not out of the rut. The Honda of old would not accept anything less than double-digit wins in a year. They are far, far, far from that. If you get Fabio, you have your fast talisman. We know he can't develop a bike worth a damn over at Yamaha. Never has been able to. You still need the feedback. But Mir is fast. Mir is a world champion.
I was going to say.
Mir is capable of blowing away Marini when he can keep the bike upright.
You know what I think might happen here? I agree with Cam. If you're going to build a team around Fabio Quartararo, I think it makes more sense for Marini to be your second guy. Johan Mir Gresini Rider 2027. Who says no?
I take it.
I'm pretty sure Raptor just hit the ceiling and will never be seen again in our chat.
Because if there was a free agency boon for Gresini, who now low-key, and we'll get to them in a bit, and now have arguably the best open seat left, if what we think is gonna happen, of all the talented riders left on the board, is there anyone with more upside than Yoann Mir? Because I don't think there is.
I don't think there is. Look, we talked in the winter about the potential that he might be kicked down to World Superbikes, which surely the value of winning a world championship has to mean something. Surely the value of getting two podiums has to mean something for last season with Honda. Yes, he drops the bike a lot. Yes, it feels like he's racing on borrowed time, but I have to have this feeling that if he's more confident on this bike, maybe the results and the consistency will come with it, even if it doesn't save his job at Honda. Now, here's another thing I want to consider, because on the satellite team, we know what Johann Zarco is at this point, right? Experience, technical nous. What does success look like for Diogo Moreira, who was pretty good last season, MotoGP, all things considered?
Well, in the words of a former HRC manager, just sign a rookie. Riders are like light bulbs. I just don't crash all that much.
Honestly, I think top 15 in points would be a great season.
Literally anything would be better than Songkhla Chantra was last year, to the point that they ditched a lot of Japanese sponsorship money to kick him off the bike to ensure that they would get something.
It's worth pointing out, for those who don't follow the intermediate class as much in Moto2, Diogo Moreira reeled in a 61-point deficit to Manu Gonzalez to win that championship with four wins in the class last year in what was the most loaded Moto2 season, arguably, of all time. It was a year last year where we had 11 different race winners, the most in Moto2 history, and six of them won more than one race. That field is loaded.
So we should have been following Moto2 the whole time.
It was the best championship of the three last year. There was no intrigue in the
top class last year.
There was no intrigue in the top class, and Jose Antonio Rueda dominated Moto3 last year, had the quietest 10-win season you'll ever see in your life. I thought we had another Alonso on our hands for a second there. Maybe not quite there. He's a baby Yoann Mir, not quite a baby David Alonso, which is still ludicrous to say that a 10-win season's like, no big deal. Joe Kelso was racing with him. But the point I'm getting at here is that Moreira won Moto2 in a class that was heaped with talent this year. Arguably the most it's ever had. I still maintain right now 9 or 10 dudes could win the Moto2 title this year, and it would not surprise me at all. So for me, Moreira, if he's semi-regular in the points, I think that's more than enough. Quite frankly, I think top 15 would be a great target. That's where Mir was in the points last year. Marini was 13th. 50-60 points over the course of the year, not too many crashes, and just learning the bike. He's on a 3-year deal with Honda. This is a long-term project. Don't run before you can walk is always what I would say. You've got time. Honda believe in him. You know, like, give it time.
And they're going to love him in Guyana. That much can be certain. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. That's Honda in a nutshell. We go down the vibe scale, but up the Constructors' Championship to KTM, which is a familiar setup. No changes in riders from last year. On the factory bikes, it's Pedro Acosta and Brad Binder. At Tech 3, the satellite team, it's Maverick Vinales and Enea Bastianini. So, again, it's familiar, but there's been big changes behind the scenes. KTM is now fully owned by Bajaj Auto, taking up the option to completely buy the Pura Group out. What that means for the racing division of KTM is still up in the air, but a tug of war could commence over whether that department is sold to a third party. Also, Hervé Poncharal stepping back from TEP 3, having sold the team to a consortium led by reality TV star and former Ford World Rally team director Gunther Steiner. The race team itself is in need of a refresh. The big one is that we are almost certain they will be losing Pedro Acosta to Ducati for 2027 with
It could be announced before this podcast goes out, is what I've been told.
Yes. So very likely, almost certain, they'll be losing Acosta. Alex Marquez likely heading the other way from Gresini. Not sure if that's an upgrade. Anyway, Maverick Vinales back to 100%, thankfully, but question marks remain over the Ford of Brad Binder and Enea Bastianini. KTM looked like contenders at their best, but chronic inconsistency remains their biggest problem, and that's just the front-facing issues. And here's where I turn over to Jalopnik's Ryan Eric King. Sadly, he couldn't be here with us tonight. So, we got Dre and Cam.
This is a very interesting team that I think is being pulled in quite a few different directions. I say this is weird because around, like, 11 months ago, KTM's leading rider wasn't Pedro Acosta, it was Maverick Vinales. Maverick was second over the line in Qatar. He was looking really strong, had a string of top five results. I thought, this is looking like a really good year for Maverick. And then he broke his shoulder off in Germany.
He broke the top of his shoulder off.
Yes, more on him in a minute, but that Pedro really came along in the second half of the season, really only because he spent the first half bitching to anyone who was prepared to listen, please take my buyout clause and put me on your bike for 6 million euros, and everyone else was like, ha-ha, no. Pedro had one foot out the door as much as a year ago, quite frankly, and he's gotten his wish. He's going to get the factory Ducati seat. My first thought looking at this team now is, now what? Because there's a lot going on here. You've got, on the Tech 3 side, you've got Hervé Poncharal going. He had 35 years in the paddock, was the owner of this team. Gunther Steiner openly admits he knows nothing about bike racing, but he's got a consortium that he thinks does. And I don't know what that means for Tech 3 from a performance standpoint or a commercial one, because I'm actually quite curious to see what a Formula One brain does in MotoGP's environment. Especially,
it's a bit like when Doralton bought into Williams, but if Williams wasn't as bad as they were at the time, Doralton bought them off the Williams family.
Yeah, their riders were 18th and 14th in points last year. They're better than that. At least I know Maverick was tracking like maybe top six until the injury this year. So they've got talent. We've said this many a time about KTM. The rider lineups are not the problem. The problem now is that who's going to be your talisman rider? We are pretty confident Alex Marquez is going there from Gresini next year. Alex Marquez wants his factory money, and KTM prepared to give it to him. I'm not sure that's a better rider than what Pedro was doing on that team. I'm as much as Alex was brilliant last year, it's a very small sample size.
One year, and we know what the GP24 was. As a bike, because pretty much everyone who threw a leg over it immediately got superpowers. And what is the KTM if not a little bit weird and a little bit not anything to expect something out of up until the point where it is fighting for a win? The biggest thing KTM this year, besides the fact that they survived, it is frankly a shock that they got to this year with the racing program intact. Every year KTM has the same thing. Well, they could be fighting for wins, or they might be struggling to be in the top 10.
That's what I think they are. I mean, we saw it last year. On a good day, Pedro Acosta was a genuine threat to win multiple races last year. We banged on the door. Why is he still not
won?
For Fermin Aldeguer took his lunch money.
It is wild that Pedro Acosta is one of like only six dudes on this grid that has not won a Grand Prix yet in his career, and two of them are rookies. It is wild. But he was banging on that door repeatedly at the end of last season. He was a genuine, like a Portimao was probably the strongest showing there, where he very nearly won the sprint, got into a bar fight with Alex Marquez. And only a inhuman Marco Bezzecchi was able to stop him that weekend. So Acosta's an elite rider in this sport now. He's a genuine top five level talent. He is everything we thought he was going to be as a prospect. No wonder Ducati's tied him up, because that's their future. And I'll say it right now on the record, that's a future world champion. And I have no doubt in my mind about that whatsoever.
We have thought that ever since he won that race in Moto 3 from the pit lane.
But as a 16-year-old, as the second youngest lightweight class champion of all time, he was a day older than Loris Caparossi when he won his. And Loris was a freak back then when he was a teenager in the mid-90s. No, Acosta is a future world champion in waiting. KTM just didn't give him a bite that could justify him staying. Brad Binder's kind of in a weird place. He was best non-Duke in this series for a good few years. He struggled a lot last year. Could not qualify
the thing worth a damn last year, and then they had to undo a lot of that damage in race trim, and often he couldn't with the nature of how these late-stage aero and ride height device monsters ride.
He's going on 5 years without a win. He's didn't have a podium finish in a Grand Prix at all last season. Like, it was a tough season for him. He's getting up there in years. Wonder how many more chances he's going to get at this.
He's been KTM's anchor pretty much since day one. Since he came up into the top. Even when he was in Moto 2, he was a Red Bull guy. He had been the talisman for their team until Acosta rolled up. And I think that's dented his confidence to a degree, because back half of last year, he was half a second slower than Acosta in qualifying trim. That's a cry for help, quite frankly. And that is not ideal. And there's also Enea Bastianini on the Tech 3 side of things who really struggled in the front two thirds of races last year. That is a guy that has got all the talent in the world and could not put it down in 2025.
Enea Bastianini has to evolve to become something other than the greatest motorcycle rider in the history of bikes for the last 25% of a Grand Prix.
Because we've seen it before with him. He was third in the championship in 2022 with Grassini with four Grand Prix victories.
He was on a Ducati.
And it's like the second...
He was on a Ducati with
the second he got
the best crew chief in the sport. And was able to be in position that when that X factor would kick in, he would be in position to go punish people with it. And the KTM just is not that.
Nothing is, really.
No. I'm genuinely intrigued as to how this team plays its hand next year. We don't even know whether CF Motor will put down the alleged $100 million they will need to buy KTM's racing division. This might be a very different looking rebranded team next year, depending on whether Bajaj get their way. Because we said it before, Bajaj told the world via media straight up, we want to cut KTM's costs by 50%.
What's the first thing that goes?
The motorsport. Yep. Every time. And KTM's old school dudes on their board do not want to give up the racing. Their tagline is literally ready to race.
It is their brand. Their brand is racing.
You know, but something's got to give in that tug of war. It might be a case where the racing division gets sold off. But I would also say, if there's one thing that might make you feel better, if you're Ryan Eric King, They are allegedly leading the development race on the 850 engines. They were the first team to literally fire theirs up behind closed doors, as far as we know. So it looks
that's good. Like that's a slight better than the other manufacturer in World Championship Racing that is desperate to cut costs and its motorsport involvement. That one being blue and French.
Yeah.
Next episode. Let's talk about Aprilia. which has the best foothold it's ever had going into a MotoGP season. And we were around when times were really, really, really bad. But seriously, we mean it this time. The vibes are good now at Aprilia. Four wins last season, including a surprise dub for Trackhouse's Raul Fernandez. But
Truckhouse?
How much of that was a lack of Marc Marquez down the stretch of the season? Because if Aprilia wants to contend, it likely needs to at least double that win count. But they've likely got one more year of a healthy Jorge Martin before he heads to Yamaha? Hey, don't cry for them, though. They've only gone and snagged Francesco Bagnaia as a replacement. We believe it's very likely to be confirmed. Aprilia would get its all-Italian dream team with two of the five best riders in the world on their bicycles. Could be worse. And in the final season of the Aero and Ride Height Device Monsters, they have pushed the regulations to the breaking point. They have broken into the bags.
The latest and shipment of crack is the biggest ever.
Got a kilo of Colombian Bam Bam in the engineer's office. But seriously, can they take the fight to Ducati? That's what we're all wondering.
That's the million-dollar question, ain't it, Ricky?
It is, and it's a fascinating team to look at because, like I said, they had their best run of form ever as a manufacturer. Like, I need to point out something here. I have not forgotten when this team came back to MotoGP 10 years ago with their overweight, chubby bikes, headlined by the cooked Stefan Bradl and Alvaro Bautista pre-World Superbike.
It was a superbike that was put in the microwave.
Yes, and it wasn't. This was a long. They've come a hell of a long way. Scott Redding's line since then.
You can only do so much to polish a turd.
Yes, and he lasted a long time at Aprilia as a direct result of that talk. Ask Sam Lowes about how that felt for him. This is a team that's come a long way. They owe Aleix Espargaró a lot of beer, the amount of development work he did. Maverick Viñales was a big contributor as well, a race winner for them in years past. Now they've got quite possibly the man who could be the nearest to take the fight to Mark this year in Marco Bezzecchi, who was awesome last year, especially in the back half. Again, I mentioned it. He was racking up podiums for fun, and there was multiple races last year where he was the one who was giving Mark something to think about. Like Misano was a fantastic race. That was as much as you'll get to a proper old school dogfight in MotoGP, where it was basically those two time attacking, and it was one error from Marco that opened the door for Mark to beat him. That's how close it was, basically. You know, Marco is sensational. He was so happy he married his bike in the off-season. You know, it was the best bit of social media we had all pre-season. But Bez is him. We don't know what Jorge Martin's going to be. That could be a fascinating wild card.
At this rate.
He's healthy. That's a plus.
He doesn't want to be here.
We haven't seen him healthy.
He wants out of here so bad, he's willing to go to the depths of Yamaha to just get the hell away from this thing he chose.
Yeah, but again, as Dre has talked about many times, if you're convinced that bike is going to kill you and Jorge Martin had bad first, second, third, fourth impressions on it,
then you're going to the motorcycle that just busted Fabio Quartararo's hand and he was flipping off.
Someone's got to pull them out of that, Rob.
It's amazing because you look at Jorge Martin's public perception of a guy that genuinely seems to love that crew that he's got around him. They gave him a hero's welcome when he came seventh in Brno, his first real race back last year. He speaks glowingly about that crew. He talks about them publicly on their team radio feature that they've trialed out in his garage for the last year or so. You know, he rolled up to their All-Stars meeting in the middle of their contract dispute last year. By all accounts, Jorge Martin doesn't look like a guy that hates being there. If anything, I'd argue the opposite, but behind the scenes, it's like, get me the fuck out of here. I will ride a factory Yamaha if I have to. And he's 28 now, and he's going to burn his prime years with Yamaha? He must hate it there.
At some point, he's going to run out of manufacturers to burn that bridge with.
But didn't we used to think this about Johann Zarco, though?
Yeah, like, look, the thing is, right, talent trumps all. And Johann Zarco was no scrub, even when he bailed out. He made the wrong decision.
He bailed on KTM, right? He was riding for Aventia Esponsorama Racing when they were the dregs of the grid, because that was about the only place that would take him on at that time.
On a two-year-old bike, and he still got on the podium. Yeah. And that's my point.
And now we think of Johann Zarco as this respected, gritty veteran who does things the right way. I remember when the perception was different.
He needed to spend half a decade in the shit, basically, to get that reputation back. Jorge Martin doesn't feel like the guy who's patient enough to go through that process.
It really doesn't, and like I said, if you're prepared to go to factory Yamaha, and don't get me wrong, like, if you know Martin's career, he's burned bridges in arguably two at least different places, maybe three. Ducati burned the bridge with him. Yeah, Ducati, he got fucked the other way around a couple of times over. 2022, he was knocked back for Andrea Bastianini. That made some sense. 2024, they had a handshake agreement with Martin in place to go to the factory team. They turned around at the last minute and signed Marc Marquez. On any level, that's shitty behavior from Ducati. It's unprofessional. You can't give a guy a handshake deal and then go back anywhere when Marquez becomes available, even though I get that it's Marc Marquez. Mm-hmm. It's shitty business practices. If it happened to you, you'd be incensed. Yes. All right. And so, yeah, he's burnt bridges with multiple manufacturers. Because I remember KTM, and the fact he weaseled out of a KTM deal when he was in Moto 2 because he wasn't top 20 in the points when he got hurt. And he was able to walk away from them without coming up to ride a KTM MotoGP bike. I haven't forgotten Jorge Martin. Pepperidge Farm remembers. And let me tell you, if you're going to factory Yamaha at age 28 in your prime season, something has gone catastrophically wrong. And I don't know. Like I said, I mentioned it before, that as Arj alluded to, if you think that bike's going to kill you, nothing will convince you otherwise. This is crazy, though, because this is an Aprilia that might have enough juice to challenge for a title. And he's prepared to walk away from it. Just to facilitate the Yamaha deal. That's
three other riders are making it work.
Yeah. Bez has been brilliant. Raul Fernandez won a Grand Prix last year.
Iger had flashes at the start of the season, but like, man, we were so happy that Raul Fernandez finally realized some of that Honda S2000 potential.
Raul Fernandez rode like a top five rider the back quarter of last season, where he won in Phillip Island, he was challenging for a podium in Mandalika, and then he ran Marco Bezzecchi all the way to the flag in Valencia. If that's the new Raul Fernandez, look out. Yeah. That is a weapon.
And Max in the chat made the point, he should have picked Honda. Honda tried last year, but the contract situation got so bad, they basically backed off and said, look, sort yourself out and we'll talk to you. And, well, they didn't. The artist formerly known as Dorna had to step in and go, set your house in order, or you will not have a spot in this sport.
Yeah, we will not sign, we will not license a rider on the grid that's stuck in contract limbo.
Respectfully to Jorge Martin, world champion, if I'm picking between him and Fabio, I'm taking Fabio.
All day, every day. And I love Jorge Martin, but I'll always have a fear that Jorge Martin will stab me in the front. So, you know, I'm not sure how much I'll be able to trust him, quite frankly, on that one.
To talk about Aprilia itself, that motorcycle is hilarious to look at. Like, it is.
It looks like a stealth bomber.
The wings have grown even more. It now is covered in spikes on the back. It's got strakes all over the ground effect pods. It is the last and greatest abuse of motorcycle aerodynamics before all the shit gets cut off the bikes for next year.
It's got wings on its
wings. I know,
wings.
It's great. It's like a 2008 F1 car. It's like we put a wing on the diffuser on the wing.
We stuck wheels on a jet motorbike.
I still love every time that a new, like a Formula One fan or a sports car fan will look at Aprilia's bike for the first time. This happened to Taylor in our Discord server at one point. Hmm. It was like, what the fuck is that? And I'm like, is that a diffuser? And I'm like, yes, yes it is.
Don't worry, 2 years ago, they had a blown diffuser on the bike and they had to take it off. Which,
yes.
A blown diffuser on a motorcycle. Still so fucking self-Aprilia. I can't.
They're going to look back at this era and just think, man, these are such wonderful masterpieces. Thank God we got away from this, though, because these were looking silly. Just like the late 2000s F1 cars with their massive Viking
couple years
and stuff, you know, like, just completely losing the plot.
05-06 was like perfect for F1. 07 when like the McLaren started looking silly mid-year. Back on track.
We've got to talk a little bit here about the fact that we've not talked about this on the pod yet. The seeming fact that it's looking like Pecco Bagnaia is going to an Aprilia. What a snag that is for Aprilia going forward.
Look, we've been down on Pecco Bagnaia a lot last season for not being Marc Marquez, but do not get it twisted. He's still one of the top three, top five riders in this sport.
He better be this year. The more wild thing is that it didn't matter whether he will or will not be. Ducati dumped him anyway. And never even gave him a grace period on a not GP25 to get his house in order. They just signed Pedro Acosta.
They were like, we can sign Acosta? Nah, fuck it. Like, burn in the hand. Burn in the hand. No, it is.
I see this working out great for both parties.
Honestly,
do not get it twisted.
Yeah, like this is one of those sorts of deals where it could easily work out well for everybody involved. The thing I think there's a legitimate chance that Pecco Bagnaia could win this year's World Championship. Davide Tardozzi was very adamant after the test. He thinks Pecco's got his mojo back. And if that's if it's Pecco at full power, it's the dream matchup we've been waiting for. Could you imagine him potentially doing a CM Punk and going to Aprilia carrying the world title like Jorge Martin did?
Well, I can only imagine how bad it will go then.
Because the way it is right now, Ducati have treated its riders like assets for quite some time now. And let's put it to you this way. You could call this an American sports trade. Ducati effectively traded Enea Bastianini, Jorge Martin, Marco Bezzecchi, and Pecco Bagnaia for Marc Marquez and Pedro Acosta. Is that a worthwhile trade? Probably.
Depends on the draft pick compensation. Are those top 10 protected, et cetera, et cetera?
Depends how badly you want to tank in the NBA these days, but you get my point in the sense of...
We have taken the MotoGP. It's called Tier D concessions.
Like... Ducati threw away their pyramid structure of bringing riders up the ladder into the factory team to basically win now with Marc Marquez and then win for the future of Pedro Acosta. And they're probably going to get away with it because they've blown through a boatload of talent to get to this point. Like, you're talking MotoGP race winners, title contenders, guys that have been top three in the points overall multiple times.
Multiple world champions.
And a world champion in Jorge Martin.
Two.
Like a guy that pulls
you now.
Stand on the way out. Two now. Three world championships between Martin and Bagnaia, and they've thrown it all for Pedro Acosta. This better work.
And the thing is, I mean, since we're talking about Ducati, I mean, we're here now. The Death Star, it's back for 2026, and it's better than ever. Reinforcements after a 2025 season, they made a mess out of, but still won 16 out of 2022, because when you put Marc Marquez on your bike, you win. But it came at a price, more movement. Pecco Bagnaia is gone after his chaotic season, after it seems like he has his motive back. In comes the potentially terrifying Pedro Acosta for next season. Alex Marquez is likely chasing his bag as he would head to KTM. Vini Grassini all of a sudden has the best seat left on the board alongside talented rookie race winner Fermin Aldeguer. And in case of emergency, VR46 is still here with Fabio Di Giantonio and Franco Morbidelli. As chaotic a pair as it gets in MotoGP. Oh, and the GP26 looks very fast. As fast as anything Ducati's built to date. We all know the real question here. Can you stop Mark from winning? Let me check here. 10 MotoGP World Championships, or is it eight? I don't know. I don't know anymore.
It's more than a number. I know Dre was wearing out the keyboard, copying, pasting stars during the Haters Guide.
Thanks, RJ.
Ducati fixed the bike. A bike that won everything available last year. Oh, dear God.
That's smart. This Mark Marquez is just that guy. They'll just like, he'll ride the wheels off of anything. Great, good, fair,
god awful, unrideable garbage.
Yeah, he's done all five, right, to varying degrees of success.
A small reminder that Mark Marquez, including sprints, won 25 races out of a possible 36 last season.
Casual reminder that until his injury late on, it looked like he was going to win the championship, not even including the sprints.
15 in a row in the middle of last season, from Aragon sprint all the way until Catalunya sprint in September. It was a run of the gods, quite
frankly. Our Motorsport 101 athlete of the year in the face of the greatest American open wheel season in the history of ever.
And I really hope that we have the Pekka Bagnaia of old back on the grid this year.
More fun.
Spoiler, I'm not going to pick him for winning the world championship.
You got burned real fucking bad
my lesson
last year.
But man, I really hope we get those two just beating it out one another, especially with the needle of Bagnaia moving teams. And by the way, if you're a fan of other sports, just thinking like, wait a second, you can just have an entire lame duck season. We have rules on tampering in our sports. Nah, but motorsports is different, dog.
Nope, including technical engineers that will bring your shit to another team and then try to have it photocopied. Oops.
Yeah, I really hope we get the old Pekka Bagnaia back, and it's at least interesting with Mark Marquez. This is not me hating on Mark Marquez. I love to see some Mark Marquez, but man, wouldn't it be great to just see them matched up more evenly?
At absolute minimum, Pekka cannot have another season where he is good on his good days and genuinely like unwatchably bad on his bad days, to the point where he was crashing and dumping the bike trying to catch some cat Chantra on an LCR Honda. That cannot happen again.
Seems like those days are behind him. Bagnaia was glowing off the back of the tests in Miraram and Sepang. He seems a lot happier. He said he found his braking confidence almost immediately on the GP26 as opposed to last year's bike.
You scrape that six off. Is there a four under there?
Quite possibly, for all I know, the engine certainly is. They're going to keep the GP24 engine in its final year of development here in 26. That's already been confirmed and homologated. It's worth pointing out, we've completely not even talked about Alex Marquez yet, who might be leaving this team, but let's not forget, was championship runner-up this year, won three times, including a pair of sprints, and was excellent, outstanding last season. And let's not forget, by all measure, he was the fastest man in testing across the 5 days we had. Alex Marquez has been fast as hell.
Well, you do run a MotoGP test. If you could run the whole season at Sepang, he would win at least 20 of those. He loves
it. Malaysian citizen.
And Grazini continues to be the little team that could, because between him and Aldeguer, who by all accounts has lived up to the hype, he was fucking fantastic second half of last year, and still had flashes in the first half. He doesn't know enough to be afraid.
Grassini, if they are losing Alex, they've now got the best seat left on the board, and they can pretty much take their pick of whoever they want. I think if Yoann Mir's on the open market, I think you make a beeline for him. If not, why not ask Enea Bastianini to come home? There's a
plug him on the. I mean, in theory, you get him on the 26. Well, whatever will be the factory bike, and then reunite him with Frankie Karcecki.
Why not?
Yeah,
that's nothing wrong with that. You bring Enea back, he's a race winner immediately. He's that good. He's won like nearly half a dozen Grand Prix on a Ducati. He knows what he's doing on good machinery.
Yeah.
You know. And VR46 is here as well.
They exist. Digi Antonio, happier with this bike compared to last year. This bike ends up being once again kind of a GP20X of 24 engine. Top half is 25 aero because they showed up with ears bigger than my German Shepherd Luna on the side of that that fairing. Just fucking huge wings on it. Those don't work.
It's like a chipmunk with two nuts in either side of its mouth.
It really is.
It was enormous.
They ditched that, so it's going to be a 24 engine in a 26 chassis with 25 aero on the top and 26 aero on the sides. The GP20X saga continues. All we know is pretty much everyone was happy with it. Mark Marquez is still devastatingly fast, despite the fact that he had the shits in preseason.
Yeah, the burnaround test, he had food poisoning and three crashes, and everyone and their mother saw the first seven laps of his long run and was like,
oh, God.
Hashtag straight effing water.
Elite internet poll. Yes, what have we done but give Mark Marquez another 2 to 3 tenths to play with of lap time? Oh, God.
Oh,
who's the stewards in this race?
He was the only man in the 29s in that long run until the crash happened. And he's happy enough with the state of his shoulder that he's apparently signed a new 2-year extension that will be announced very soon.
That was up in the air. Shockingly, that was up in the air for like a good 3 weeks.
We think the last 2-year extension he signs because, I mean, he's now one of the, if not the old, not the oldest rider, because I know Zarco's here, but you know, he's had a long career, a very long and successful career. He doesn't have to keep doing this until he's 40 like Valentino Rossi did.
I suppose it depends. Like, Mark Marquez is motivated by one thing and one thing only, beating everyone else.
He's obsessed with winning.
Like, it's not the money. It's not the taking part. It's destroying every Valentino Rossi record left.
The only question mark, and I think Raptor's right to say this, is can his body handle this? Because he turned 33 last week. This would take him to his age 35 season if he signed this 2-year extension. Like, he openly admits his body is starting to fail him. He cannot recover like he did when he was Mr. Javon Evans, Mr. Bouncy, when he was in his early 20s.
I'm going to go into practice. I'm going to crash. I'm going to go, okay, 99% of that every lap.
Yes, this is a man that once flung himself off a bike at 210 miles an hour when he was a Honda and basically had a cut lip and not much else. He can't do that anymore. His body has taken a lot of punishment over the last 13 years. He's the most experienced man in the field now. He's the one man left that's ridden an 800. He's the last one.
Crazy.
He never raced on one. I think the question becomes, is the pain worth it? Well, one thing makes the pain worth it. Can he continue winning? On the evidence of last year, yes, he very much can. It took a genuine burnout style takedown to end his season.
It was the greatest comeback in motorsport, and he made it just look like no adversity in the small term picture. We know the big term picture, he's come through a lot to get back to being a world champion, but just in the 2025 season, you wouldn't think he would have had to overcome a whole lot
in a single season in the same team. He like permanently damaged Francesco Bagnaia's legacy
to the point where the team said it wasn't worth keeping him anymore.
That is a terrifying prospect. Can Mark continue to win on current evidence? And until I think until he can no longer consistently win, unless he does have something that just puts him out, I don't see him stopping because the money doesn't matter.
As long as he's motivated and thinks he can win, I think he will stick around. There's a short answer on that one. Yeah. Right. Let's make some predictions before we get out of here. We've gone for this actually a very brisk pace. I'm very happy with that. Right.
Yeah.
Should you just get the champion pick of Mark Marquez out of the way now and move on? Yeah. Cool.
That's the safe pick. But who's finishing second, Dre?
This is what I think is a more interesting question. Because I think there's three
This is
dudes.
Where I'm picking Francesco Bagnaia to finish second in the world championship. Not first. I've learned my lesson.
I think there's four dudes who could finish second, conceivably. I think Banyaya, I think Alex Marquez, I think Bez, and I think Pedro Acosta. I think they all could, with the right circumstances, finish P2. I'm gonna say Pecco. I think he'll be back to something near his best, and I think he'll win four or five races next year.
Yeah, probably Pecco.
Wow, all unanimous there too. Interesting. Does anyone outside of Ducati or Aprilia win a race?
I think they do. Acosta's overdue at this point.
KTM is overdue. They are on a long dry spell.
Over 4 years since Miguel Oliveira's last win for them.
And don't rule out Honda victory, Honda victories, plural.
I think Honda could notch
one. Yamaha.
I think the Honda could, I really liked what I saw out of them in preseason. I think if we get something suitably wacky enough and Mir hasn't thrown the bike at the scenery, he could notch one.
Yeah. Wet race, Matt's going outside
crazy. Matt's going outside shot of Jorge Martin. It's Ducati and Aprilia that we're betting on, dog.
Yeah, those it is very clearly those two and then everyone else.
So here's the thing. How many Ducati wins? Over and under, Dre, you said it. 18 and a half.
I set the over under to I think that's an interesting number.
18 and a half.
Given that Aprilia won four last year, and Honda won one as well.
And Yamaha should have gone.
That's a high mark. Really? Yeah, they should have won Silverstone by all accounts.
I'm going to take the under.
Wow.
I'm going to notch it right at the under. I'm going to say 17.
RJ, what do you reckon?
I think Aprilia will notch
the under as well. I think Ducati gets about, between all the riders, about 16 wins.
Same as last year, then.
They'll still get the majority, sure.
I'm taking the over.
Oh, surely not.
I think the ceiling of Ducati is higher now than it was last year. Mark, purely from a manufacturer standpoint, this year seemingly has backup. If Bagnaia is fit, healthy, and well, he will win races. Alex Marquez is the third bullet in the chamber, and he won three last year. I think I'm taking the over here. I think Aprilia is on a bit of a false dawn. I think they'll still win two or three where they're really strong. Like Mandalika, they were super strong there last year. Busted out the arse. But I think maybe 19 or 20 Ducati win this year. I'm going to take the over.
I think Aprilia will. Wow. I think Aprilia will be pretty similar to what they were last. I think the bike will be a little bit better on merit. The biggest thing with Aprilia, and kind of throw it back to that section, it's no longer the specialist bike. It is good at pretty much everything. But is it good enough at everything to beat the other bike that's good at everything? So I have to see.
Great question.
Really good question.
One more city season fun one. How many Moto2 graduates?
I can think of at least one. This feels like David Alonso's year to go up. I mean, was finalist for Rider of the Year in 2024 for a reason. He was very, very good in Moto3, and he was very, very good as a rookie in Moto2. And I feel like this is the year he's going to win the championship. I think you get at least one.
I think three. I think both Aspars could potentially move up. I think a lot of people are sleeping on Danny Holgado, who won multiple Moto2 races last season. Watching him was like watching a young Jorge Lorenzo, and that's a compliment.
That's a scary thing to say to someone.
That was a buttery smooth race winner when he was on it in Moto2. Alonso was a bit wacky when he won his one race in Moto2 last year at Ballater Park, although that was from 11th on the grid. It's worth pointing out. I think him. I think both Aspars could move up, and I think maybe one more between two Red Bull affiliated riders. I think Colin Vaya is one to watch in Moto2 this year, and I think it's risky because he's coming off a major injury. Watch out for Dennis Onchu. You heard it here first.
And Dennis Onchu accomplished what his older brother Can could not.
I'm going to say two. I'm going to go with Alonso and Holgado. I really do rate Holgado.
I like two as well. Just quick clarification, Matt was picking Jorge Martin for second in the world championship.
Good luck with
not
that.
To win motorcycles races for
good luck with that.
Ducati and not a brilliant.
It's
a bold pick.
Sample size.
There is no sample size. The order never came in.
That's my.
Yeah.
The Dart Hatch was delivered.
The sample size is way too small. I know, but there you have it, folks. That's our MotoGP season preview. Round one this weekend in Thailand, March 1st. We'll be back next week to review that. That's going to be fun to keep an eye on. Hope you guys enjoyed the show. We'll be back next week with reviews of MotoGP, IndyCar, and a probable Formula One season preview as well. We'll sort out the running order. There's a lot going on next week, to say the least. We'll be back sometime next week to discuss it all and break it all down then. Until then, I've been Dre Harrison. They've been RJ O'Connell and Cam Buckley. That's been Our Bikes. We'll see you next week. Sayonara.